Hello, my name is Paul LeClaire, and it's my privilege to be the president of the greatest library in the world, the New York Public Library, and to welcome you all to the Bartos Forum for this fall season's version of a special lunch for friends here at the New York Public Library. Even though it doesn't feel like fall, we might as well take advantage of this wonderful weather and our wonderful friendship with you and your wonderful friendship with us to come together to hear a spectacularly wonderful and truly important and marvelous writer as part of this ongoing series at the library. Events such as this are a way that we have of thanking you for being our friends, and we couldn't do this kind of event without the wonderful cooperation of volunteers at the library, especially Lynn Goldberg and Wendy Nicholson and the program committee of the Friends Group, who have organized again this year a wonderful afternoon for you at the library. The New York Public Library is the most remarkable library anywhere, I think, for a few important reasons that it's worth reminding all of us of. One is the fact that anyone from anywhere, regardless of where they come from, what their social or economic status is, what their interest is, anyone from anywhere in the world can come to use our 91 libraries completely for free and with no questions asked. There is no more democratically accessible great library system than this one. There are no other great research libraries and research collections such as this one that are open to the broadest imaginable public completely for free. We're able to provide that level of access only because we have friends and supporters. What most people in New York don't know, and there are good reasons that they don't know it because the name of the library can be so misleading at times, but what most people don't realize is that the research libraries in our system, and you're in one today, are funded primarily by the private sector. Even though it says the New York Public Library, this is really a private library under private control and funded primarily by the private sector. What does primarily mean? Well, the city provides only 25% of the annual operating support for the research libraries. They provide virtually all of the operating support for the branch libraries, but very little, actually, for the research libraries. And if you add the city and federal support that we get on an annual basis, that still only comes to a third of the cost of running the great research collections and research libraries here. And after that, we're on our own. So where does the other two-thirds come from? One-third comes from our endowment, and the third third comes from our friends of all kinds at all different levels. That's an enormous amount of money that we have to raise every year. That's close to, some days, $1 million a week privately to make this library as great as it is and to keep it as great as it is. And you might say, well, that's a heroic level of fundraising, but the thing that we have going for us is our own generosity to the public, which encourages others who believe in the importance of that in our city to be generous in turn to us. And our friends group is one of the single most important membership groups that we have. And so your contributions to the library are all simply to help us make the great collections, the great information sources that we have here, computers, free internet access to the world of information on the web, available to this immense audience that is our mission and the source of our great pride to serve. So thank you. Thank you for being such wonderful supporters of the library. Thank you for being our friends. If you're not a friend, become a friend. If you're thinking about special gifts to give people for birthdays or Hanukkah or whatever, think of giving them the gift of being a friend of the New York Public Library. I can't imagine anything better. So let me now turn the program over to Wendy Nicholson, who herself had a great, great career in the publishing industry, who has the pleasant task of introducing today's wonderful speaker to you. Wendy?
Thank you very much, Dr. LeClaire. Good afternoon and welcome. The Friends Program Committee is very pleased to offer you today's program, and we do thank you for coming. Before we begin, please take a moment to look at your cell phone or any other electronic device you carry that rings, beeps, or sings, and make certain that you have turned it off or at least put it on vibrate. Judith Thurman will take questions at the conclusion of her talk. To ask a question, please use one of the microphones on either side. There we are. On either side of the room so that you can be heard by both our speaker and by the audience. And as Dr. LeClaire has so eloquently reminded us, the library needs our financial support. If you are already a friend or if you would like to become a friend, membership brochures are available at the table by the doorway. If you would like to get information about upcoming programs by email, there is a sign-up sheet at the membership table. Following today's lecture, books will be available for purchase, and Ms. Thurman will sign them. These sales benefit the library, and the speakers who come to the library generously donate their time. Judith Thurman is an award-winning biographer and a widely published literary critic, cultural journalist, and translator of poetry. A staff writer at The New Yorker, Thurman's subjects have ranged from profiles of Madame de Pompadour to the Italian performance artist Vanessa Beecroft, from the history of New York row houses to the art of making tofu, from portraits and profiles of great writers and artists to essays on various aspects of haute couture, its history, its designers and consumers, its creative exuberance and significance. Ms. Thurman's curiosity, penetrating intellect, wit, and unsentimental gaze make her one of our finest prose stylists. Her newest book, Cleopatra's Nose, 39 Varieties of Desire, is a collection of essays and profiles representing 20 years of her celebrated writing for The New Yorker, particularly her fascination with human vanity, femininity, and so-called women's work. Judith Thurman is not only a dazzling essayist, she is also a distinguished biographer. She is the author of Isaac Dinesen, The Life of a Storyteller, which won the National Book Award for Biography in 1983, and Secrets of the Flesh, A Life of Colette, which won the Los Angeles Times Book Award for Biography in 1999 and was a National Book Award finalist as well. In 2004, the American Academy of Arts and Letters awarded her the Harold D. Vercell Memorial Award for prose style. Please welcome Judith Thurman.
Good afternoon. It's an incredible honor. It's very moving for me to speak at the library and to do a small part in helping to raise money for the library. I have worked here. I've spent hours in various places and doing research and reading. I worked briefly in the writer's room when I didn't have a studio of my own. I've kind of haunted this place. And it was here, actually, in 1983 that the National Book Award was awarded. It was a very gala and special night for me. I thought I would talk a bit about being a critic, but the subject of my enduring obsession, writing sentences. I would like to know how to write, but I can't say that I do. What I do know is what good writing is and isn't, and when I'm not doing it. I struggle for a sense of reality about my words on a page, but they play devilish tricks on me. Colette describes the nightmare very well when she writes of quitting work for the day and leaving on her writing desk a blazing branch of fresh chrysanthemums, only to return the next morning to find a shriveled twig. Prose that rings true isn't static, yet it somehow has to become stable. Head, gut, and ear, my internal panel of judges, at least one of which is Simon Cowlish, have to agree about it. I also wish I knew what I thought about a subject from the outset, but I never do. I cannot formulate an idea or an opinion, not to say a conviction, until I have written a sentence that reveals to me what I truly think and feel. When my work is going well, it surprises me with a truth that has been hiding in plain sight, its clarity materializing out of nowhere. Just as a different arrangement of the same molecules can produce a lump of coal or an organism, a piece of prose can lie on the page, glittering perhaps but inert, until you hit upon the spell that brings it to life. I'm using spell in both senses, a sequence of words which, in excluding a near infinity of other possible combinations, conveys a precisely calibrated meaning, and a rhythmic invocation through which language recovers its archaic power to animate what is lost, latent, or dead. There are other times when a sentence seems to surge from a deep wellspring of memory, experience, or intuition. But I can't reach that wellspring without arduous drilling through a mantle of shale that I call my stupidity, a stony, unyielding dullness. I know objectively that I'm not stupid, and when I write a phrase that withstands the harsh scrutiny over and over that I give to phrases, it makes me inordinately happy, and those are the moments that keep me going. I graduated from college at 20 and never went back for a graduate degree or to teach. Ironically, the life of a critic at The New Yorker is very much the life of a graduate student, except that you pick or are assigned a new thesis topic every month or so, and not necessarily in your field of expertise. You immerse yourself in its arcana as deeply as you can, which, to be honest, isn't very deeply, given the constraints of a tight deadline. Falling back upon the same habits, cramming and trots, and the same stimulants that students resort to, and with the same anxiety about getting less than an A, you produce your paper. The New Yorker is a culture of A students. Yet this hyper-intense and competitive life is only congenial to a part of me. The two major books that I've written, biographies of Dinesen and Colette, evolved very slowly over 7 years in the first case and 8 in the second, and I had the luxury of living with my subjects intimately, out of sight, and of working through my own uncertainties and ignorance about them, my clouded judgments and emotions, and slowly distilling the prose, purging it of the tics, infelicities, feints, showing off, stunts, false starts, and clichés that one resorts to in desperation when one really doesn't yet know what one means to say. An essay for The New Yorker, on the other hand, generally takes about a month, and at times as little as a few days, from the start of the research to the finished draft of 4,000 or 5,000 words. New Yorker writers enjoy the luxury of exceptionally rigorous and literate editing and of thorough critical fact-checking, so you have more support than most writers get. You also internalize your editor and the fact-checkers, and they become your conscience, and you answer to them as you write. That beholdenness is both time-consuming and inhibiting, though it saves you a lot of grief at the other end. There is no support, however, for the hardest and most painful part of the process, the drilling, and no shortcuts either, at least none that I have found. I spoke at Columbia to creative writing students not long ago, and they were heartened, they said, to hear that a critic and biographer who has been at it now for some 30 years still panics and flounders and endures a crippling sense of incapacity. Experience does not, oddly, make writing easier. Poise and confidence do not, for some reason, accrue to writers. Every assignment feels like your debut. My debut at The New Yorker was an essay on Nadine Gordimer, and it took about 6 weeks to write. About that time, 1987, I met John Updike at a party, and I asked him how long it took him to write a book review. "A weekend is about right, wouldn't you say?" he replied. I now produce from 6 to 11 essays a year, so I've learned to work faster, but never without writer's block. And writer's block is not a function of the amount of time you suffer with it, but it's a state of dread. And I think it's the dread of exposure, and that happens every time I start a new piece. Literature is different in that respect from other vocations in which your training and conditioning see you through the crises. For most writers whom I know, The Shining is the ultimate horror movie, and not because of Room 237, the flashbacks to the axe murders, the refrigerator, the labyrinth, or the déjà vu. It's the scene where Wendy begins looking through Jack's manuscript and discovers that a ream of paper has been covered with the same sentence. I'm told that Kubrick had every page individually typed. Here I thought it might be interesting to interject my own much less dramatic version of that scene by reading you the early drafts of a first paragraph and the finished one. The essay in question is called Night Kitchens, and it was published in the New Yorker's annual food issue 2 years ago. The subject was tofu. Great, I thought. What fun. Tofu. This is going to be easy. Beware, I have learned of anything that smacks of fun. The reporting took me to Japan for two rapturous weeks. I visited some of the places where great artisanal tofu is made, and I spent a week in Kyoto visiting the temples where tofu cuisine was born. Everything about the trip was a revelation. I love to travel by myself also, and I've noticed that lust and wanderlust have more than a semantic rapport. They both simultaneously dissolve your bearings and refresh your keenness of sensation. I'm never afraid of following a back street or a country path, diverging from an itinerary, learning a few words of an exotic language, and surrendering to the unknown. The writing process also dissolves your bearings, and its object is in part to refresh a reader's keenness of sensation. But my nonchalance mysteriously deserts me when I start to write. I'm terrified of being stranded in a wilderness of my own perverse creation. I've tried mapping the terrain before I enter it, making an outline, but no outline, program, no linear or rational set of directions has ever, in my experience, generated a good sentence. And panic sets in when my vital supplies of stamina and clarity begin to run low, and path after path leads to a dead end, and it feels as though my instincts have betrayed me. Deliverance only comes when I stumble upon the one passage out of an almost infinite number of possible choices that leads to the light. Between July 12th, when I started writing, and August 4th, when I filed a draft of the piece, I wrote 28 versions of it, which is fairly typical. Most were repetitive, the same beginning spinning its wheels. All work and no play makes Jack a dull boy. I won't bore you with 22 of them. And the 6 brief excerpts that I will read do not, at this remove, I have to confess, sound so terrible to me. I even managed to use some of them in altered form elsewhere in the body of the essay. But the final opening had a definitive quality that the others didn't. It wasn't arbitrary. Draft 1. I usually don't begin drinking at 11 in the morning, but when Yoshimasa Kawashima, a celebrated tofu maker, oenophile, and bon vivant, uncorked a bottle of perfectly chilled 1972 Gevrey Chambertin in the kitchen of his farmhouse on a hillside outside the city of Karatsu on the west coast of Japan, I couldn't say no. The rainy season started late in Japan this year. For the first 3 weeks of June, the rice paddies shimmered under a milky haze. Housewives, vain of their pallor, went to market wearing hats and gloves or pedaled their bicycles with one hand, the other hoisting a parasol. Many, perhaps most, came home with a package of tofu, which in one form or another is a staple of the national diet. Version 3. I had such a good time in Karatsu, I was determined to do that sort of 19th century geological survey. Karatsu is a small port city in the Saga Prefecture on the west coast of Japan, famous for its pottery, a fortified samurai castle from the 17th century that dominates the bay, a spectacularly eroded shoreline furrowed with caves and cliffs, an ancient tract of virgin pines that fringes a fine beach, and a rowdy, picturesque Shinto harvest festival that attracts 500,000 tourists every November. More recently, it has also become known for its tofu. Version 4. Karatsu is one of Japan's westernmost cities, closest to Korea, on the island of Kyushu. The nearest bullet train or direct flight from Tokyo arrives at Fukuoka, the prefectural capital, about an hour away by public transportation. As you travel southwest on the crowded subway, the cars empty out, the train emerges into the countryside and follows a spectacularly eroded coastline. I was really determined coastline. When it reaches the Karatsu station, you are far from the hipness and density of urban Japan. The city is a former whaling port famous for, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But off-season, it is a provincial backwater with a pleasant beach fringed by an ancient forest of black pines, fortified pagoda, and the rest of the other attributes. That, all of these sort of geographical things put me in a state of total despair. I wasn't getting anywhere. I couldn't get out of the eroded cliff line. And so I thought I would dump this whole approach and start something entirely different. Draft 5. Writing about tofu, like cooking with it, is a challenge to one's powers of invention. And I was going to introduce a subject somewhat lacking in inherent drama with this story about my ex-mother-in-law, a vagabond of waifish charm who briefly made a living growing wheatgrass in the back of her VW camper and selling its juice with missionary ardor at health food fairs. And who, about 30 years ago, concerned that my eating habits and those of her son were poisoning our youth and helping to despoil the planet, gave us a copy of The Book of Tofu, an essential reference work on the history of soybean curd and its cuisine by William Shurtleff and Akiko Ayogaki, which is still in print. But having recently spent 3 weeks in Japan living largely on tofu, I lost 5 pounds and feel great. And watching it made with equal measures of reverence, gusto, and virtuosity by elderly fisherwomen, Zen monks, rakish oinophiles, that oinophile was very important to get in there, and ninth-generation masters of the art, I realized with a guilty pang that tofu is, at least among the unenlightened, the mother-in-law of foodstuffs. Without the slightest twinge of conscience, people feel entitled to make jokes at tofu's expense, rolling their eyes like Rodney Dangerfield while it bobs guilelessly in its tray of cloudy water at the salad bar, or gaily retailing their first encounter at some wacky vegan Thanksgiving in the wilds of Marin County with that tired trope of hippie fundamentalism, the tofu turkey. None of this was working. The tight close-up, the jokey tone, the impacted descriptions, the lush overwriting, the hint of dissipation, the self-conscious cleverness, the orientalism, etc., etc. I knew in my heart they were all a betrayal of the subject. Something essential was missing. But as it often happens, that just as I'm on the brink of conceding failure, a brink familiar to my editor, Virginia Cannon, the recipient of countless desperate emails submitting my resignation from the staff at 3 a.m, I found the way out. And this is the final first paragraph. The abbot's garden at the temple of Daisen Inn in Kyoto is a rectangle of raked gravel bordered by a white wall on one of its long sides and the wooden porch of an old pavilion on the other where the monks meditate. From behind the wall, a camellia bush throws off its scent. The grooves made by the rake run horizontally like steady but freehand rulings on a blank page until they eddy around 2 conical mounds, each about 1 foot tall. One evening last June, just after the temple closed, I joined the sitting meditation held on the porch and open to the public 2x a week. There were 5 other sitters, all Japanese, one a young mother who had her children in tow, 2 plump boys and a little girl. I could hear them squirming at the end of the row, and once or twice the presiding monk spoke to them in a low voice, breaking the silence. But after a while, with an impressive show of stoicism, they managed to keep still. I had been to Daisen Inn earlier that week, and at my first sight of the stones, I shocked myself by bursting into tears, perhaps because, for all its austerity, the garden is an image of release, of the moment at which, after an intractable struggle, you get permission from yourself to let the inessential go. In last week's New Yorker, there was an interesting profile of Jacques Balzan, the critic and historian who's 100 years old and still working. He had the kind of education that's rare in the modern world, as did Walter Benjamin, who's my great hero among essayists, and in a different register entirely, Susan Sontag, whose education was always a work in progress. Yet in spite of his degrees and awards, writes Arthur Crystal, the author of the profile, Barzin regards himself in many respects as an amateur, someone who takes genuine pleasure in what he learns about. He has stood for the seemingly contradictory ideas of scholarly rigor and unaffected enthusiasm. Benjamin and Sontag were great amateurs, too, in that sense. And at the highest level, a critic is someone who knows how to love. Expressing enthusiasm for an artist or work is more difficult than it seems, and in my own much humbler experience, considerably more difficult than being critical. The point was driven home to me recently at a board meeting for a grassroots charity, a foundation that teaches yoga to impoverished children in Sri Lanka and Indonesia. The board was trying to hammer out a mission statement, and the usual cliches about hope and empowerment were bandied about. Then one of the board members read a one-line mission statement from another foundation. Our goal is the sustainable end of world hunger. Period. The end of hunger, a clean, concrete negative with more uplift than any number of positive and fuzzy generalities about hearts and minds. The language of positive thinking proves to be extremely sloppy. No one was, of course, saying how a sustainable end to hunger could be brought about, a minor detail, but it let me reflect on the challenge of expressing unaffected enthusiasm with a punch of rigor and on the related challenge of doing justice to a character for whom one does not have much enthusiasm at all. I have written my share of negative reviews, none more scathing, perhaps, than Doing It in the Road, a critique of Catherine Millet's The Sexual Life of Catherine M., which was published in English in 2002. The tone of that piece is summed up, I think, in two sentences from it. Lust is a great and inexhaustible literary subject, but writing graphically about what excites one isn't literature. The same stupid things excite everybody. I stand by my judgment, but I did leave an unfairly harsh old review of Margaret Atwood's novel Cat's Eye out of Cleopatra's Nose, because rereading it almost 20 years later, I realized that I had gone after what I then perceived as Atwood's arrogance and sanctimony, and to take her down a peg, rather than considering her admirable writing with dispassion. Atwood, I figured at the time, priggishly, could take it. She was a big star. But self-appointed vigilantism is not book reviewing. Grandiosity gets my goat. It did both in Millet's case and in Atwood's, and also in writing about Edna St. Vincent Millay, Louisa Cassati, and André Malraux. Though men and women seem to suffer from grandiosity in different ways, men tend toward fantasies of omnipotence and women of uniqueness. Having an antipathy, however, is an occasion for making an imaginative connection, not despite the antipathy, but through it. Grandiosity, my distaste for grandiosity in writers has its roots in my chagrin at knowing that I share the same failing. I was that insufferable little know-it-all whom my fifth-grade teacher liked to call Miss Importance. So criticism would seem to have been my destiny. The piece that I am proudest of in Cleopatra's Nose was written under external rather than internal stress. I was getting divorced at the time. And perhaps that was a relief because the writing flowed. I would like to end the talk by reading a part of it. It's a love poem of sorts, although its subject is a writer who loathed effusions and did his best to make himself unlovable. I don't pretend that I do him justice, but perhaps the best a critic can hope for is to do justice to her own feelings. And it's called An Unsimple Heart. It's appropriate because it begins with a great scene in a library. I once spent a year in the manuscript room of the old French National Library on the Rue de Richelieu. Toward the end of my stay, the curator offered to give me a going-away present, a day at My Carrel with any manuscript in her archives. I had nearly all of French literature to choose from, but there was no contest. I asked for Flaubert's The Sentimental Education. This greatest Bildungsroman, one of the first modern novels, tells the mock-epic, tragicomic story of Frédéric Moreau, a provincial dilettante who fritters away an inheritance on the wrong women, friends, pleasures, investments, and causes, and whose ambitions are thwarted as methodically as his illusions are demolished. The book was published in 1869, 13 years after Madame Bovary, to excoriating reviews. Writers of an ironic temperament revere it for the qualities that have alienated the larger reading public, its arduous purity of style, its uncompromising pessimism free of cant, and its refusal to ennoble human nature. Flaubert wrote a rabidly depressed letter about the novel's reception to his friend George Sand, and she responded with a maternal nudge typical of their correspondence, for she liked to pretend that his misanthropy was an affectation. This man who is so kind, so friendly, so cheerful, so simple, so congenial, why does he want to discourage us from living, she wondered rhetorically. But Sand, who foraged tirelessly for pleasure and companionship and wrote with complacent fluency, misunderstood the tonic nature of Flaubert's despair. Less of the world is more for him because there can never be enough, and his discouragement with life sets the bar that his pitiless ambition keeps forcing him to transcend. The draft of The Sentimental Education runs to 2,500 chagrin-bound folio pages, a fortune in stationery. The writer, so wary of self-indulgence, was profligate with ink and paper. He covered his leaves minutely on both sides with wiry black script. Almost every line is altered or crossed out, then recopied dozens of times. The manuscript has the aspect of a battlefield on which each inch of forward momentum has been wrested at exorbitant human cost from an implacable enemy. An epitaph for this expensive valor comes to mind. Flaubert's words of mourning and consolation from a scene halfway into Madame Bovary, where Emma's romantic effusions begin fatally to bore her lover, Rodolphe. Here the author inserts a very rare editorial aside, a defense of his heroine's ineloquence, which sounds like a plea to his own conscience for mercy. As if the soul's fullness didn't sometimes overflow into the emptiest of metaphors, for no one ever can give the exact measure of his needs, his apprehensions, or his sorrows. And human speech is like a cracked cauldron on which we bang out tunes that make bears dance when we want to move the stars to pity. The best literary biographies give the most exact possible measure of the overflow from a writer's being into his work. In that respect, Flaubert's Life by Geoffrey Wall is an admirable, if not completely satisfying, book. The author, a British university professor, has a penchant for the pastoral we, and he occasionally succumbs to what, for a Flaubertian, is the fatal pitfall of solemnity. Discussing Hérodia, the last of the three tales, Wall complains, as might a 19th century cleric writing to the Journal de Rouen, that the ending lacks a proper sense of exaltation. Why? Because the disciples of John the Baptist set off for Galilee with his severed head on a dish, and as it was very heavy, they each carried it in turn. He finds this a conclusion so inscrutably prosaic that it leaves us yearning for the poetry of the sacred, he writes. But only two things are sacred to Flaubert, impiety and perfection. Anyone foolhardy enough to enter the lists with Flaubert must submit to the ordeal by humiliation of sharing a page with his sentences, and Wall survives. His style has flair, if at times too much, and so does his erudition. Citing the famous passage at the end of The Education, which must be one of the bleakest elegies ever written, seven telescopic sentences devoid of embellishment that sum up the futility of Frederick's later life, Wall notes that Flaubert is showing his successors how to smuggle their old romantic contraband into a modern realist novel. He understands that cunning is necessary when dealing with an obsessive teaser and connoisseur of farce. It is daunting enough to establish a critical beachhead on a character so well defended, in Wall's words, by lucid comic anguish. But it is practically impossible to ascertain when Flaubert's self-mockery is contrived and to resist its subversiveness. He was a man who could write of his own violent moods. I go from exasperation to a state of collapse, then I recover and go from prostration to fury, so that my average state is one of being annoyed. 2 weeks before his death, he told his niece, "Sometimes I think I'm liquefying like an old camembert." Wall's condensed portrait is drawn mostly from previously published material, and it doesn't, perhaps wasn't intended to enrich Flaubert's scholarship. Earlier biographers have mapped the terrain in multiple volumes. Wall is not as dogged as Enid Starkey, as urbane as Francis Stiegmüller, or as microscopic as Sartre. No abbreviation of the life may ever match the cranky wit and wry felicity of Julian Barnes' Flaubert's Parrot, which enjoys the riffing privileges of fiction. But the author of the Dictionary of Received Ideas, the glossary of clichés that Flaubert appended to Bouvard and Pécuchet, his Encyclopedia of Human Stupidity, in novel form, would surely have bellowed with joy at the themes listed after his name in Wall's index. With a few minor omissions, they are as follows. Flaubert, Gustave. Aesthetic mysticism, alleged sadism, artistic intransigence, attitude to marriage, castration complex, celebrity and influence, Chevalier de la Légion d'honneur, death, debts, dogs, fatness, hallucinations, interest in history, masturbation, modernity, pleasure taken in books, pleasure taken in traveling, realism, recitations, romanticism, sexual abstinence, sexual initiation, sexual passion, syphilis, use of prostitutes, and views on book illustrations. Flaubert might also have argued against spoiling the effect of such a deliciously incriminating catalog with the clutter of elaboration. And I will stop here because I'm looking at the time very conveniently posted, because I would love to hear your questions. I think a dialogue is actually, in some ways, much more interesting than a lecture. So please do not be shy. Yes, it's a back and forth. The question was, does the New Yorker always assign topics or can you pick your own? It's a back and forth. You can propose topics. Sometimes they're proposed. You can always say no. Nobody forces you to write something. But there are many ideas that are laid out and suggested, and then you can say yes or no.
Was fasting your idea?
Yes, fasting was my idea. I had these food issues seem to be... Well, there are occasions for fun, but I had just been to one of these places doing a film, and when they said, "What would you like to write about for the food issue?" I said, "How about writing about not eating?" And so that was sort of accepted. But that piece seems to have been laughed at a lot. I'm sure you have questions. This was a question about Out of Africa, which was my biography of Dinesen was probably the major property that was used in writing the script, and I worked on the film for 5 months in Africa, and it was working on a big film is both incredibly boring and incredibly fun. It's like court life. You have to be there. You have to be standing. You can't do anything else. And at the same time, you have nothing to do. So that's actually where I started smoking at the age of 34. But the boredom is sort of contemplative. Over and over and over again, the scenes are shot, 10 takes, 5 takes, 10 takes. I don't know. I mean, it's a big subject. I could go on, But did you have a specific question about the film? I think it's a long question. I think that the film is a translation. It's not. I mean, people say, "Did you like it?" And I did like it. I don't think it's either Out of Africa or my book. It's a romantic translation of her life, interpreted by other people. And I think one thing I will say about Meryl Streep. I think the tension in Streep between the head and the body, the cerebral. The sort of the cerebral actress who's, you can sort of, she's, you don't see the cogs going around, but she's thinking, she's always thinking about her work, and this very sort of sensual and passionate the bad girl who would like to sort of forget the cerebral process. I think she got that very, very well. More questions?
I'd just like to know how you got the idea for writing
that was proposed. I had written a piece about Dinesen for Ms. magazine in the 70s when Ms. was doing, they had a column called Lost Women, and at that point, all kinds of women writers who'd been neglected, most of them foreign, were being rediscovered, and I had written about some other lost women, Louise Labé and Sor Juana Inés de la Cruz and Dinesen. And so a young editor at the time who had always wanted to commission a biography asked me if I would do it, and I said no initially because I had no experience in research and writing a big book in nonfiction at all. I was writing poetry for myself. So that's how it came about. There was another. Hi, Janet. I will never write another soup-to-nuts biography. In fact, I have a suicide pact with my friend Jean Strauss that if either of us ever signs a contract for one of these gargantuan decade-long books, the other one has to shoot her. But I have a small project, which I can't really talk about at the moment. It's biography-like, and it's not about a famous person. It's a profile, sort of life of a soul. I'm too old now. It would take, but I'm not sure that readers anymore want to read 1,000-page books. I really sort of think that the cameo biography is perhaps more relevant to the. No, well, you're atypical, so. Has writing for The New Yorker changed my voice? Yeah, I think it's gotten more minimalist. I think that I sort of partly as you're running and you're getting hot, you're jettisoning things just to make your life simpler. You're jettisoning a kind of elaborate, slightly, I'm tempted by kind of Rococo sentences, Jamesian sentences, these very, very long sentences. You can't do that when you have so many deadlines. So I think my writing has gotten much simpler. I think it's gotten more noun-y as opposed to noun and verb-y. And it's a mixture of essays and it's a mixture of reportage. The art of the reporter has influenced the art of the essayist a lot, I think, for The New Yorker. It's not sort of the kind of free essay that somebody just writing for their own scholarly pleasure is permitted even to produce. Oh dear. Uh-huh. Oh. Now that is actually, that's a good question. The lecture was about the impossibility of writing a decent sentence and the struggles. The lecture was about how hard writing is and what a nightmarish experience it is until suddenly you are surprised by what you didn't know. Hi. That was the other thing that happens is that current events are put on a big calendar, and everybody, all the critics, pour through them to see what they might like to, what's coming up, and what we might like to do. I saw that, and I wanted to write about it. And then there were all of these other things happening in Paris that made it a slightly bigger piece. I was very eager to do that. Yeah. It's changed. It's certainly, the offices are much bigger and modern. Many of the writers only come in to close a piece. They're not, some people have offices on the 21st floor. but you don't really sort of see your colleagues. It's still pretty collegial, but it's not. I remember the old offices, and it's not the same. That was also because of the personality of Mr. Sean. It did have a kind of cult-like or temple-like atmosphere that I think emanated from him. It was almost an ashram. I don't know. I mean, there are some. David writes. He and Anthony alternate, so he does a piece every other week, which the critics with regular beats. I don't know. But I once asked Luke Menand, who I met at a dinner party in New York on a Friday night, and I said, "Luke, what are you writing?" And he said something about metaphysical poets plus the existentialists plus Heidegger. And I thought, "Oh well, when is it for?" He said, "Monday."
Hello, here.
Wait, one second. I'm just going to finish this story. And I said, "How do you write like that? How do you write so quickly?" And he said, "I'm a bricklayer, just one brick at a time, one row at a time." So he doesn't do this sort of organic, crazy thing, and I think David is probably the same. Also, David has one subject of which he's a complete master. He's not jumping around. So he's writing from tremendous authority, that years and years and years of grounding.
I'm sorry. As a retired teacher, I had to follow the rules of the hostess about using the mics. I have Cleopatra's Nose on hold at the local library. Could you give us a vorspeis about the title?
Of the title.
Please.
Yes, it's in the introduction, but since there's no reason why you should have to read the introduction. Cleopatra's Nose comes from Pascal's Pensée. And let me just read you the little bit. So since I spent so much time writing the introduction, I'll only mangle it if I try to ad lib. Pensée is really a musing on carnal attachments, which in a funny way is my subject. Anyone who wants to know the full extent of human vanity has only to consider the causes and effects of love, Pascal wrote. Cleopatra's nose, had it been shorter, the whole face of the world would have been changed. Had it been shorter, it was to me, very long-nosed, a charming twist. The idea that in the 17th century, noses were you had to have a serious nose to be considered a serious person. So the connection was really with this great Christian moralist, evangelical moralist, writing about vanity with Morris. He was obviously one of the greatest stylists of all times, and that kind of paradox interested me. And I wanted the other thing, these sort of petty calculations, I wanted the essay on Cleopatra to come last, so I figured that giving the book, putting Cleopatra in the title was a smart idea.
Thank you. When you write a piece about a person in a profile, very often, of course, you try to focus on the greatness of that person. Then there is also personality, a person's life,
Right. Well, this is a question that goes to... The question was about Leni Riefenstahl, and was it possible? How did I strike a balance in that piece between what was clearly antipathy to everything that she stood for and a fair evaluation of work that was, in fact, great? Although, in the end, I wasn't so sure her work was so great. It's a given that her work is great. Everybody has repeated it. But I went back and looked at every frame of all of those films, and they are, some of them are great, and some of them are just incredibly tedious, and some of them are sentimental, and some of them are corny. And the conclusion was that for a masterpiece has to be better than the trailer. And And Riefenstahl's work has been condensed, and so what most people know of Riefenstahl's work is the shortened, condensed versions of it, not the work in its... But it goes back to what I was trying to say about antipathy and working. If you really have an antipathy for somebody, they are arousing something in you. There is an identification there, and if you find out what it is, if you can sort of face it in yourself, you can be fairer to them. Oh, on essay writing? I like, well, Susan Sontag's essays, Benjamin's essays, Adorno, I mean, sort of the Germans. But I also like Joan Didion's essays a lot. In fact, everybody, I think, most writers have a writer who is, you know, like when you're launching your boat into a lake and, you know, the sort of the trailer thing that glides in. Some writer's sentences have that. They help glide you into the lake. And Didion's prose has that effect on me. It's very... I'm not sure what... I would like to know exactly what it is. So I read her. She's also very, very, very clear thinking about politics. Edmund Wilson, Updike's reviewing, the tremendous facility that he has. Let's see. Who do I turn to? And it's not just essayists. I mean, sort of different pieces of prose. Sjöran, I love too. I think, but Benjamin is the rock. One, yes, Jeannie. What was the most traumatic? Oh, yes, that was the most traumatic piece. David Remnick thought it would be interesting to assign somebody whose beat was not politics to write a profile of Teresa Heinz Kerry. And because of the languages in Africa and various other things, he thought I'd be a good person. And we both really underestimated my naivete in writing a piece on politics. And the piece went on and on and on, and I kept going back out into the field to get more, to find more inside dirt, to report in a more objective way. It was a nightmare, and I was ready to give it up. And everyone sort of said at some point, well, just throw it in. This is crazy. You're making yourself crazy. But I find it very hard to do that. So I just went on until finally there was a usable draft of it. But I don't know. I didn't. I guess I wasn't tough enough to write about politics in a way that David thought was.
I guess I was looking for the story about how important the balance is in the writer's life at certain moments.
The bath, yes. Well, that was a different one. That was. This is Jeannie knows me very well. This is a story about giving up. I was writing a piece on a Met show, a wonderful show, extreme fashion, and it had to be done in 3 days. And I was in despair, and I called my editor, who was Sharon Delano, my previous editor, who's a wonderful editor in a different way. And I said, Sharon, I can't do it. You've got to try to get me more time. And she said, okay, go take a bath. Just lie down. Go take a bath. Forget everything. Wash your hair. And I promise you I'll get you some more time. So I went and I took a long, luxurious bath, and as I got into the water, the tension started to dissolve, and my first paragraph came to me. I jumped out of the bath, dripping wet, and I called Sharon. I said, Sharon, I have a first paragraph. She said, good, I was never going to get you more time.